a bunch of bills.
The Senate State and Local Government Committee will come to order. Today is Monday 17. I think that's supposed to be March 17th, 2014. The people should really let us know, tell the page over here, if you have some travel issues, if you're from out of town. I haven't looked to see what the weather is like. I don't know if it's snowing or sleeting. But do let us know so that we can try to make arrangements. I know Senator Jensen is one that has some people here from out of town, and we'll try to accommodate her. So in the meantime, Senator Marty, Senate File 36, welcome to the State and Local Government Committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
We do have a quorum, and just as a reminder to the audience, the testifiers, and the members, is we are going to try. Obviously, the author needs to give us an overview of the bill, but this is generally they've come to us from other policy committees, and so we should try to just stick to our jurisdiction. And I can say that because Senator Peterson isn't here. Senator Marty.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Senate File 36 is a bill that's been a long time coming. It's been at the Capitol for 6 or 7 years now. It's been through two committees, as you mentioned, agriculture and jobs, and also judiciary. But this is an issue that would require commercial dog and cat breeders, which is defined as over 10 breeding adults and at least 5 total litters a year, to be licensed by the Board of Animal Health. And this is to address some concerns. There are occasionally, I think in the last year or two, there have been 3 Minnesota cruelty cases. Some will say, hey, they're already licensed by U.S. Department of Agriculture, and each of those 3 that I'm mentioning all had been inspected by them, but they're not inspecting for our laws, for animal cruelty laws and so on. And our law until this bill has been complaint-based. If there's a complaints about cruelty or something, it can be investigated, and that's kind of too late at that time. The harm is done to the animals, and that's not the way we want to deal with our laws. In a case where there have been people are running commercial businesses, fairly significantly sized ones, most of them doing very honorable work, but some who are cutting corners in unfair ways, this is sort of a preventive bill. Regulation would make sure that they are inspected and that they're operated in a good manner, a healthy manner. And with that, Madam Chair, I will say before we have the first witness that this bill is now supported by the Minnesota Board of Veterinary Medicine, the Minnesota Farmers Union, and a number of other organizations. I'm happy to stand for questions, but perhaps you want to take the testimony as well. And I only have one witness, Mr. Keith Streff.
Counsel, Ms. Stengel, could you remind us and Ms. James what our jurisdiction is with this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Unlike some of the other bills that we've had, it's a little bit tricky to pinpoint the exact sections.
Okay.
But the policy before us that is throughout the bill is relating to the local animal control authorities and the new obligations that would come on to cities and counties. So whether the relationship between the state and the local governments and those parameters are properly defined and workable.
Okay. Ms. James?
Madam Chair and members, in addition, our jurisdiction extends to the Office of Administrative Hearings and Administrative Procedures, and page 8 has a significant amount of provisions relating to that.
Am I missing part of the bill or something? I want to see page 9. File 36. Letters. I think I'm missing. Can you give anyone else is missing?
Just 4.
So everyone else has the bill. I just was missing my copy. So I just looked for it. Okay, Senator Marty, and your witness.
Yes, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Streff, and I'm the senior humane agent for the Animal Humane Society based in Golden Valley. I've been employed with the Animal Humane Society since 1987, and I also have a long history of farming and biology, criminal justice, and I have a police background as well. I'm a licensed peace officer with the jurisdiction in southwestern Minnesota, and I work on a part-time basis at that agency as well. The Animal Humane Society is the largest animal welfare organization in the upper Midwest, and I'm here today to speak in strong support of Senate File 36. As a humane agent, one of my responsibilities is to respond to citizen complaints regarding animals that are subject to situations and conditions alleged to be in violation of the Animal Welfare Chapter as it exists today. I'm sure you've all heard or read or seen some of the horrific animal neglect cases that have been publicized over the years. Many of those cases I've been the lead investigator on. Oftentimes, these cases involve dozens, sometimes hundreds of dogs. Some are sick, some are injured, some diseased, some are dying, and some dead. I've witnessed dogs fed roadkill, amateur practice, C-sections, and or whatever else is necessary to ensure that the puppies are available for sale. And that's what drives this particular bill. Some of these environments require hazmat suits just to enter, and sometimes breathing aids are needed to due to the staggering amount of excrement and odor and potential pathogen. Madam Chair and committee members, Minnesota does not have any language in state law that specifically regulates commercial dog and cat breeding facilities today. There are no required inspections. There's no current licensing program. Senate File 36 provides regulation which is preventative, inspecting and then addressing problem situations in breeding facilities before they escalate to a point where the animals need to be seized. Existing law only allows me and other law enforcement to respond after a complaint is filed, and that's an important aspect in this bill, and you'll hear testimony to that effect. It's been my professional experience that after a complaint is filed, it's typically too late. Oftentimes, the conditions are so acute that there are few options available but to seize the animals. Other states, such as Wisconsin, Iowa, and Nebraska, also have similar language, similar to this bill. Senate File 36 will allow the Board of Animal Health to identify, correct, and prevent a catastrophic environment before it develops. Uniform statewide regulation will save municipalities and law enforcement money in the long term. For example, take the costs associated with having to seize animals from a breeding facility where a valid complaint has been filed. Again, keeping in mind that the only way IR and law enforcement hears about these cases is after a problem is observed and if someone files a complaint. Current law specifically states that expenses related to animal cruelty cases shall be paid by the county. That's in existing language today. This incentivizes the county to overlook the problem and push it on to local humane societies. These cases are becoming too frequent and too costly for Animal Humane Society to continue to burden these costs. In any of these cases, the number of animals involved is directly commensurate with the cost of an intervention. Take, for example, a breeder with dozens or perhaps hundreds of animals in a facility. A breeder that's inspected and found to have problems would be issued correction orders. Through this process, the breeder is given an opportunity to meet the minimum standards required by the Animal Welfare Chapter's statutes that we're using today. If the breeder is unable or unwilling to comply, the Board of Animal Health would have the legal authority to take enforcement action. There are several due process provisions built into this bill so that seizing animals is not the first step. Contrary today, when I show up and conditions are acute or frequently catastrophic, there's no good alternative option available today. The bill's intent is to regulate the industry to the extent that ensures sound, healthy animals. I urge your support of Senate File 36, and I'll be happy to answer any questions as the testimony progresses.
Okay, are there any questions? Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Mr. Streff, we understand, obviously, it would be nice to intervene before animals are harmed or abused. Wouldn't the Animal Welfare Act that's in federal law that sets standards for how breeders are supposed to conduct themselves, wouldn't that also provide standards by which these breeders are supposed to operate?
Madam Chair, Senator Thompson.
Strath.
The answer to that question is no. Currently, we have a USDA policy in place. There's been some changes recently with USDA policy, but I've been working in this industry since 1987, and I cannot recall a single situation involving an intervention by the USDA that they found the conditions warranted seizing of the animals or shutting that licensed facility down.
Are there any other questions? All right. There are a number of people who wanted to speak in opposition. I'd like to kind of bring you up in teams. And remember that our jurisdiction is more narrowly focused on the impact this might have on local governments or the Office of Administrative Hearings, because it already has passed two policy committees, and those other areas have been covered. But Senator Peterson is welcome to ask any question he wants.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Ms. LeBeau and Ms. Gerdes. We have Valerie LeBeau and Julie Gerdes. Is Julie Gerdes here?
I am.
Okay. While you're sitting down, it says in the title that the bill authorizes rulemaking, but did that get deleted?
No, there's also some.
There is?
Yes.
I didn't really see it when I looked through the bill. Okay, great. Page six?
Yep.
All right, thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. LeBeau.
Oh, me first? Could Julie go first?
That's fine. Ms. Gerdes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Julie Gerdes, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to testify today. I do appreciate it. A little about my background. I'm a highly experienced professional pet breeder with over 25 years of experience. And I'm testifying today in opposition of SF-36 as it is currently written. I believe that instituting the statewide program that SF-36 proposes would be like putting a tourniquet on your upper arm because you have a scratch on your pinky finger. While there are some areas speckled here and there in Minnesota that don't have existing laws, I believe that this type of oversight should be left to the city and county levels where it sits now. Currently, most cities and or counties do have ordinances in place that absolutely prohibit someone to own more than 3 to 5 pets or dogs. To exceed that threshold, a person would have to apply for, pay for, and be granted a kennel license, and also often a conditional use permit is required as well. Minnesota's current city and county ordinances regarding dog and cat ownership are also non-discriminatory, as they apply whether one owns the animals as pets or for breeding, without distinction. Kennel permits and conditional use permits are also often limited to only those people that own a certain number of acres, and often there is an additional limitation that such land has to be within an agricultural zone. To obtain these permits, public hearings are typically required, notices of which are published in newspapers, and notices are mailed out to the property owners residing nearby. Planning and zoning committees must look at the plat drawings, business plans, do site inspections to make sure the buildings and fencing used are to code, to make sure that manure removal meets the requirements, that noise and odor that might be generated are regulated, and to make sure that water source contamination won't occur. The planning and zoning committees will vote after the public hearing is held, and if approved, then the kennel and CUP application will move to the city and or county city council meeting, who must hear and approve of the applications as well. Usually many conditions are placed on the licensee that they have to adhere to in order to maintain licensure. These typically include yearly inspections and renewal terms. Individual dog licensing and rabies shots are also part of the stipulations, which results in additional cost to the permit holder. So to own more than 5 dogs and get set up becoming more than a very small hobby breeder is a very difficult and expensive thing to accomplish, with many hurdles to jump over. And many applicants are turned down just because the city or town can say no, because they don't want to deal with a kennel. Minnesota has seen a 60% reduction in USDA licensed dog breeders in the last 6 years. And at the same time, Minnesota has seen a dramatic increase in the number of puppies and dogs being imported from several southern states by secondhand pet selling businesses. In fact, the Animal Humane Society's annual report shows that they now have to import over 80% of the dogs that they sell from outside of their 5-county borders in order to meet the demands Minnesotans have for pet dogs, in order to maintain their multi-million dollar income level that these sales bring in. As the number of purpose-bred puppies goes down, the sale of secondhand puppies and dogs is going up, and that is what the owners of these secondhand pet businesses who developed this bill want to continue to see. Breeders' businesses going down so that their sales can go up. SF-36 was designed by them to help them accomplish that goal. For those of you that feel there is a need for a statewide program to be developed, then I suggest that FF-36 be parked here today until it can be further developed into a much better bill. My suggestions for improvement are simple and resolve the problems it has with discrimination and would serve to provide protection and oversight to more potentially mistreated or neglected animals. I'm not suggesting that any of you vote no today, but I am asking that you consider to vote not yet. While we all know that most often a bill will never be perfect, there are some major flaws with FF-36, and my hope is that this committee sees that fact and determines that FF-36 should not move out of this committee just yet. The businesses and special interest groups who are behind us asking for this bill have purposely skewed their information they send out and have presented it in a manner as to slander their competitors. One of the most significant problems with FS 36 is that it doesn't attempt to achieve all that its backers state that it should, and that is to oversee the conditions of kennels and animals and kennels. Please notice how the promoters of this bill have left out their own pet selling businesses from this proposed regulation and inspection. Promoters of this bill use the fact that Iowa and Wisconsin have laws in place, therefore Minnesota should also. But Iowa and Wisconsin oversee all dog selling businesses, not just a segment of the industry, as is proposed under SF 36. Wisconsin's law is titled Dog Sellers and Dog Facility Operators Act, not Dog and Cat Breeders Act. Had a task force been assigned to this project early on, that information would have been presented up front to you and it would not have been kept hidden. Iowa and Wisconsin were concerned enough to want to protect all animals held in kenneling or colony situations, and they were caring enough not to want to discriminate against just a certain segment of an industry. Iowa and Wisconsin know that if someone has 30 dogs or cats in their care, that those animals' health, well-being, and safety is important, regardless of if they have had their reproductive organs removed or not. Iowa and Wisconsin were smart enough to know that regardless of who owns a 30-cat or dog-holding business, that it doesn't change the fact that their litter boxes need cleaning, poop needs scooping, floors need scrubbing, and proper ventilation is needed to maintain the health of the animals. Unfortunately, SF 36 excludes certain dog and cat selling businesses, and for me, it just begs the question of why. Humane agents and sheriff personnel across the state can tell you that rescue businesses are just as likely to be found dirty, smelly, overcrowded, and lacking in proper management as a breeding business is. Without including all pet selling businesses in this regulation like Iowa and Wisconsin does, SF 36 just is falling short. This bill should also cover pet importers, bunchers, flippers, secondhand animal selling businesses, and the animals in the care of these businesses deserve the oversight every bit as much as others do. Cities and counties should maintain being responsible for this type of licensing. They already currently are. And for some breeders, SF 36 could be the fifth layer of licensing and or inspection. Currently, AKC, USDA, city, county, and then this would apply a state level as well.
Thank you, Ms. Curtis. Senator Marty has not brought in a dozen witnesses, but he has given us this packet of statements. So I think that in fairness to the author, the opposition, you need to make your comments pretty short and not repetitive of what the previous person has said, because we don't have – we try to balance between proponents and opponents. Also, this is the third committee this has been heard in. Okay, Ms. LeBeau.
Thank you for hearing me today. My name is Valerie LeBeau, and I breed golden retrievers, beautiful dogs. I've been doing this since 2000, so for about 14 years. In order to have my kennel, I had to pay $500 for a license. I had seven people from my township come and inspect my premises, and I have regular inspections. I'm also subject to county laws, and the industry itself actually does a lot of its own inspections. Animals are AKC animals, and they're also ACA registered, and both of those organizations also do their own inspections of breeders. And as a matter of fact, I don't know of any locations in Minnesota that doesn't already regulate animal ownership and kennels through a local or county level. And that's really where it needs to be because of the needs of those specific locations. But the biggest problem that I have with this bill is that it grossly discriminates against a very small segment of the pet industry in favor of pet sellers that directly compete with breeders. And I'm speaking specifically of the large rescue and shelter industry. And one of the things that you may or may not be aware of is that those organizations that are backing this bill, they have millions and millions of dollars in assets. In fact, I'd like a page to pass around a handout that I have. Just the Animal Humane Society that Mr. Streff works for has over $21 million in assets and over $12 million in gross receipts annually. That's more than any breeder I know, and I know a lot of very big breeders as I am the former treasurer of the Minnesota Pet Breeders Association. I know a lot of big breeders, probably the biggest ones in the state. The breeders don't have the money to hire the lobbyists and do all the things that everybody else do. We're simple, small businesses, and those organizations pretend that the only animals they get are strays and those that are surrendered and those that have problems. But that's not the case. They seek animals on Facebook and Craigslist. They buy from breeders. They import from out of state. As a matter of fact, today on Facebook, there was a request for foster families for dozens of parvovirus-affected and exposed pets that they're importing from out of state today. Those kinds of things need to be regulated. They're the only organizations that hire humane agents in the state, that dress in uniforms that make them look like law enforcement, that come out to our homes. They pass us cards that have a badge on them. And then they pretend that they have the right to inspect our properties. It's like the fox guarding the hen house, and we're already subject to those kinds of things. Then they use public funds to manipulate local law enforcement to seize pets that they later are able to sell. And they exploit those seizures through the media and through other sources to get donations. Breeders don't get donations of food and veterinary care and money and all those kinds of things. We're not able to do that. We pay for those as business expenses. But these are the people that are trying to do this, and they're excluded from this bill. On the basis of the discriminatory aspect alone, this bill should not do anything. But the other thing is that this bill does nothing to stop anything that the proponents are trying to stop, such as animal cruelty, abuse, or neglect. It does not protect the consumer any more than our lemon law. It doesn't do anything to prevent disease, parasites, congenital problems. And for those reasons, it should be voted. You should vote no on this bill.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. LeBeau. Next, let's bring up Lindy Forstater and Elaine Hansen. And that will be the end of the testimony. Thank you. And please, if you could try to just address the issue of how this relates to state and local government.
I'd like to let Elaine go first.
Ms. Hansen.
We didn't orchestrate that. I'm Elaine Hansen. I thank the chairman and the committee members for giving us the opportunity to speak to the bill today. With your focus on state and local government, the most important thing that I can emphasize to you is the extent to which this bill duplicates existing federal and local and state laws. We have, as has been mentioned, an effective animal cruelty law. We also have a consumer protection law that requires breeders to have every pet examined by a veterinarian before sale, requires them to provide the history and all known conditions that the pet may have that could affect its utility, for lack of a better word, as a household pet. This applies to all pet sellers in Minnesota except for the shelters and rescues. They have no such obligations. The Minnesota Federated Humane Societies report that 70 of Minnesota's 87 counties have ordinances regulating pet ownership and breeding at either the county level or at the city and township level, such that the county is virtually overlaid with local ordinances. This bill would effectively duplicate and, in many cases, triplicate the existing regulations. I believe that Ms. Gertis said that a state bill to regulate breeders by the Board of Health, Animal Health, would be the fifth layer that many of them are required to adhere to. If it's factual that animals are not cared for by breeders and consumers get sick pets and breeders have no incentive to take care of their animals, then that's something that should be documented, and it hasn't been. There's been no presentation as to how many and how bad Minnesota pet breeders are. I would like you to be aware that many states enacted similar bills and found vast differences in the projection of how many breeders needed to be regulated and how many were actually licensed. Texas estimated at least 1,000 and has 136 licensed. Wisconsin estimated several hundred and a few dozen were licensed. There are more examples, but Tennessee deserves special recognition. Tennessee projected that 500 commercial breeders would be regulated and in 3 years' time, 20 were licensed. But it's not that number that makes Tennessee outstanding. It's the fact that they had the wisdom to put a sunset clause in the pet breeder licensing bill. The bill to extend the program beyond June 2014 has died in both chambers, and Tennessee will no longer be spending hundreds of thousands of tax dollars each year to monitor the activities of less than 24 dog and cat breeders. Now, it's true we don't know how many dog and cat breeders there are in the state and how many of them would come under this bill. The fiscal note says 475 would, but that's admittedly a guess. If the experience of other states is any clue, 475 is quite possibly by a factor of 10, an overestimate. Minnesota shouldn't commit resources to this program indefinitely, if at all. But if you are going to vote in favor of this bill, I would ask that you first amend it to include a sunset clause, as Tennessee did, to provide that the bill will expire at the end of fiscal year 2016 if it has not fulfilled its promise. In 2 years' time, it should be possible to determine just how many commercial breeders there are who are not otherwise regulated, whether a significant number of them neglect and abuse their animals and resist complying with the standards of care, whether there's a drop in substantiated cruelty complaints involving commercial breeders, and whether there's a drop in the number of complaints brought to county attorneys by consumers who purchased sick puppies and kittens from unscrupulous breeders. It would be better for Minnesota to not enact this legislation at all, but if this bill ultimately passes, please let it be with a provision to sunset the program if it does not meet the expectation that hundreds of breeders will be regulated and cruelty will be reduced and consumers will not have to bring complaints under the puppy lemon law. A sunset clause would be the most important thing you could do to improve this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Forstater, is that correct, Forstater?
Forstater, yes.
Forstater.
My name is Lindy Forstater. I've been a breeder of Shetland sheepdogs for 25 years. Many of you have my photos that I emailed out to show you that my dogs are happy and healthy dogs and well cared for. George Washington and Thomas Jefferson were dog breeders. Although I'm not going to talk about the civil rights and freedoms that this bill is seeking to erode today, or the negative effects that inspection has on the stress level and prevention of the spread of contagious diseases in dogs, please keep in mind that the dog breeder or cat breeder of today, with few exceptions, is a person of just as much character and integrity as our founding fathers. I am a hobby breeder. I have never had a large number of dogs, but even 4 adult dogs put me in the kennel license and inspection requirement of my city. It turns out that of 87 counties in Minnesota, approximately 81 have requirements on the books for the licensing and inspection of animals. On top of that, the USDA recently decided to license and inspect breeders with over 4 adult female dogs or cats who sell even 1 puppy or kitten sight unseen. On top of that, the American Kennel Club requires inspection for breeders with 3 or more litters a year. Senate File 36 would add a third or even fourth or even fifth license fee, inspection, and set of regulations to effectively bury breeders in bureaucracy. The history of this bill is worth knowing to understand where it is today. In 2007, Representative Lesch authored a bill to ban 5 popular dog breeds from the state of Minnesota: Akitas, Chow Chows, Pit Bulls, Rottweilers, and Wolf Mixes. This unjustified attack on dog breeds resulted in a backlash that culminated in his change of course to attack dog breeders instead. Supporters of this bill long insisted that it was needed to close the loophole that dogs sold from the internet over long distances did not need to come from USDA-inspected and licensed kennels. Incidentally, I do not believe that the USDA overlooks cruelty to animals in their inspections whatsoever. This so-called loophole was closed with the updated USDA rules last year. Since this bill is no longer needed and would only waste taxpayers' money, I hope I can count on you to vote no on it. And I do have several other breeders who co-own dogs, which one of them testified, and his testimony didn't seem to have an impact. Co-ownership means that I do not keep a lot of dogs at my house, but I would have a friend or a client actually own one in both of our names. And a lot of AKC breeders do that. They do not want to have, you know, 11 dogs counted at 11 different houses because they're all co-owned by the same person.
Thank you, Ms. Forstater.
And they do want them to change that. Thanks.
We need that. Senator Marty, any final comments?
Madam Chair, we've discussed a lot of these issues in other committees. I just do want to point out, I think on the handout, at least the back page of that, some of the cruelty pictures in there. We're at a place that had been inspected by USDA. What we're trying to say is they're saying all these regulations occur in Minnesota and so on, and I think the advocates have made very clear we're not saying most breeders are bad breeders. We're saying that there are some bad apples out there, and inspection program up front is a much better way than doing it by complaint.
Senator Thompson.
This is a question, Madam Chair. Thank you. Is anyone from the Board of Animal Health in here today?
Okay. Thank you to the witnesses, and if you want to give room for this gentleman to sit at the table, thank you. Welcome, and could you just state your name for the tape, please?
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Paul Anderson. I'm a veterinarian with the Board of Animal Health.
Welcome. Senator Thompson, did you have a question then for Mr. Anderson?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Anderson, I may be asked the wrong person because Mr. Streff was here from, I believe, the Humane Society. As I'm looking at the federal law on this, it strikes me that there are provisions in there to prevent cruelty and require, you know, specific kinds of protections of animals here in Minnesota, as in all the other 49 states. Am I wrong on that, or is that not the case?
Mr. Anderson.
Madam Chair, committee members, my understanding of the federal law, which is in the Code of Federal Regulations 9.1-3, is that those regulations are very similar. They do inspect these facilities and inspect for cruelty types of issues, yes.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, so what in your mind would be accomplished by essentially creating duplicative legislation, if I understood you correctly, and I'm not quoting you, but you almost said that what is in federal law is similar to what we're attempting to pass here. Why? What advantage would there be to doing something different?
Mr. Anderson could address that, or I think maybe Mr. Streff or Senator Marty, whoever.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Streff.
Senator Thompson, I'll take a swing at that. Currently, if in the last year and a half, 2 years, the three largest cases that have broke involving hundreds and in one case over 1,000 dogs, all three of those facilities were USDA licensed, USDA inspected facilities. So I would tend to think that if that program is working, that those cases wouldn't have evolved. So whatever program is in place, it's not being taken forward through compliance. So they issue correction orders, and the correction orders may or may not be followed, and the problem continues.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair, thank you. And to either of the gentlemen, Mr. Streff or Anderson, do we in the state have the authority to inspect and enforce standards based on what the federal law is?
Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Streff?
Senator Thompson, we don't have the authority to enforce federal law, and federal law fails or falls short in their inspection requirements to resolve these issues before they become catastrophic.
Thank you.
Mr. Anderson, does the Board of Animal Health have a position on this bill?
Madam Chair and committee members, we think that we're the right agency to do this if it passes. We have veterinarians and inspectors that are strategically placed throughout the state, and we've been following this bill also for a long time. It has fairly broad support now, and certainly we're happy to implement this if it passes, you bet.
Okay, any other questions? Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, just real quick, what's the purpose of the sort of narrowed focus on breeders versus anybody who houses animals?
Sure. Sure. Senator Marty. Chair, Senator Peterson, the issue, I mean, there are, again, the so-called people who have, the people who have multiple cats in their house or something who are not taking good care of them either because of whatever reason. They often, first of all, those cases, we're not trying to get at that. We're not trying to get every pet owner. We're not even dealing with the small breeders. The compromise was the 10 adults in the business. But the bottom line is we're trying to address people who have, in some cases, not, I don't know what percentage of them, I'm not trying to make a case that it's more than a small number of them, but the bottom line is who are cutting corners, perhaps to make money, perhaps to whatever, but they're doing things that are really cruel and harmful to the animals, and I think they're things that the public recognizes. They see stories about this in the paper every few months about another investigation, another child, another case of a breeder being charged with animal cruelty and people seizing animals from them. I think the point is that, again, Mr. Steff is the one here who's been involved in a lot of these investigations, and he can tell you that the problem is out there. That's why we're trying to go after them. And, again, other, I mean, some of them have been calling the nonprofit humane societies and so on secondhand pet stores or whatever. I didn't remember. It was something like that. And we've gotten some dogs from rescue shelters. They're usually asking for donations to help cover their costs because they're struggling to make it. They're not trying to see how many pets they can sell. They're not in the business of breeding them. What we're trying to do is the people who are very much often in very isolated settings raising large amounts of animals and not taking care of them, we want to make sure that we have a system in place so it's not just somebody stumbles upon it in a way and files a complaint and we have a mess to deal with. And frankly, in terms of any, I have not heard any of the humane societies or rescue programs, one of them said they're smelly and so on. But again, those places are very much open to the public, as are pet stores and everywhere else. They are licensed and they are regulated by health departments, everything else. But in terms of cruelty cases, I don't think there's been a one of those. Those are people who are doing it because of the love of animals who have often been either abandoned or lost or whatever. So I think we're trying to get at where we've seen the problem. And what I actually had earlier in the bill had a smaller number of them in a commercial breeder, but we took that out. That was the compromise.
Mr. Streff?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, I think I might be able to help you with that as well. Currently, all the 501c3 nonprofit organizations, including the animal control facilities that are required to take animals in from the public as strays, are currently licensed by the Board of Animal Health. I'm sure Dr. Anderson could explain or answer in more greater details how that's done, but we fall under their kennel licensing. So we're annually inspected, as is any organization that takes stray animals from the public.
Sam Peterson.
Just one more question, actually two more. What is in the bill that deals with animals that are maybe imported into the state of Minnesota? The regulation, and these are sincere questions. I don't, it's the first time I've heard the bill, so if someone asked me about that, you know, that maybe they've got a truckload of dogs from Alabama, you know, how do you deal with that, and they're at a store at Northtown Mall?
Mr. Streff?
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, currently the Animal Humane Society, at least ours, the one I represent here in Golden Valley, which is the largest organization, animal welfare organization in the state, we take animals in that would be slated for euthanasia. So unlike other states, there are various communities that have more animals than they have homes for, per se, and those animals would be euthanized for no other reason other than they just cannot find homes for them. Fortunately, in Minnesota, we have an opportunity to afford those animals a second chance, and we've entered into agreement with those other nonprofit agencies to bring their animals that are slated for euthanasia to our organizations so that we can find homes for them to prevent unnecessary euthanasia.
Madam Chair, I was Senator Marty, maybe. I was actually referring to how the bill addresses that situation because we're obviously regulating in-state breeders. That doesn't necessarily mean that all the dogs in Minnesota are breeded with that right. To that standard.
Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, Bottom line is we cannot be out there regulating the other states' businesses. We're hoping, again, I think 34 other states do regulate regulate in this way. So we're trying to catch up with the other states. But, yes, if there are problems in other states, I think our folks, I'm sure humane societies, if they ever find evidence of this or something, I think I'm sure they report it to the other states. But there's nothing we can do enforcement-wise to those states.
One last question, Madam Chair, just related to line 1.14 on the bill, is related to data. Data collected and maintained, there's an exception for the licensing. Could you speak to sort of why the remaining sections are classified as private or non-public? And again, I'm not sure if I know the answer to that, if that's standard practice, or I see there's some of the subject matter areas there are related to things that I think would the public data or the public would want to know about, in particular correction orders, administrative penalty orders, things of that nature. Could you speak to that?
Senator Marty.
Give you guidance on what should be public and what isn't?
Sure. Madam Chair, Senator Peterson, I would like more to be classified as public. This was the end of, as I said, this has been a 5, 6, 7 year long battle on it, and some of the folks, and I don't want to say who it was exactly that was objecting to it, maybe Mr. Steff or somebody who was involved in those discussions could tell you, but I know I think a lot of the subjects of the data were very concerned that it become public. They didn't want it. That. I would do it differently. But.
And the data section was approved by the Judiciary Committee.
It's been through Judiciary. Yeah. Yeah.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Marty, is there a fiscal note on this? Is it going to cost the state something?
Madam Chair, yes, there is, and I think I have it somewhere. It is, and this bill has to go to finance.
Okay, any other questions from members of the committee?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Hall.
How much was the fiscal note?
It's on the last page. They had 10-14. I don't know if that's still accurate, and 10-15. Senator Neumeister asked to testify, but we don't deal with data privacy issues in our committee. Did I say Senator Neumeister? Senator Neumeister. Well, I was telling you no. And he's my constituent, so he's going to be mad at me. Senator Hall, did you have any more questions?
No.
All right. Is there a motion? Senator Scalzi? Senator Scalzi moves that Senate Floor 36 will be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion prevails. All right, moving right along to Senate Bill 2256.
Paul, you want to sign?
I don't want to retalk all this.
Been on here?
Got a big agenda.
Okay, I'm going to join you on that program then.
All right, for people in the room, we have 10 bills on our agenda, so we need to move very quickly, and if you testify, please keep your testimony brief. We are a secondary referral committee in most cases, so you've had a chance to make your case at previous committees. Please try to stick to our jurisdictional issues as well. Senator Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I try to give my introduction as brief as possible. This bill, Senate 2256, calls for a temporary hold on wolf hunt in order to collect data to support the wolf management plans. It requires an annual wolf census, educational strategy to reduce conflict between wolves and humans, and set up an advisory council. The temporary hold continues until we have comprehensive accessible data, a study for public sentiment toward wolves, a development of best management practices for livestock producers to reduce wolves' depredation, and a map showing areas of wolves and human conflict. Other provisions include baiting limitation, tribal land restriction, and Zone B count training. Madam Chair, wolves are a great asset to our state. We even name our famous sport team in Minnesota here after Timberwolves, and they are an intelligent animals with social order and regard as sacred by the Anishinaabe people and other original people of this land. I ask for your support of this bill because if we're going to turn this intelligent animals, the great grandfather of species of our man best friend into a small game animal for sport, let's first collect data to justify our action. And I have with me is Dr. Maureen Hackett, who will testify and also answer any question that a community member will have. Thank you.
Okay, it looks like we have, before we hear from Ms. Hackett, we have an A2 amendment, which is, I think, from our staff, putting the advisory council language into the guidelines that we follow in this committee. Senator Johnson moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion about the amendment? All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Ms. Hackett.
Basically, the motion before you is the composition of the task force and clarification of the tribal lands piece of the original Senate file 2256, Madam Chair. I was assuming that the positions on the task force speak for themselves. I would say that the reason for such a large task force and for some of the positions is because we have baiting, trapping, and snaring still in law for recreational purposes, and we have many issues to deal with wolves being killed outside of a hunt. So the purpose of the task force is to implement the wolf management plan. The wolf management plan is to protect the wolf and to reduce conflicts between wolves and humans. So it's more than just supervising a hunt. It's actually looking at the entire wolf management plan, which I think requires the positions that you see before you on the task force.
And the task force members are appointed by the DNR commissioner, is that?
Well,
by the commissioner, it says.
I think that's what that says.
Yes, okay.
Which is why we also delineated those positions the way we, so that it was clear that we had to have some representation.
So you have two from environmental organization, two from agriculture role, two from hunting and trapping, two from wolf advocate organizations, two that represent government agencies, two from Indian tribes, two biologists or scientists, someone from an animal protection organization, and then two at large. And then we have the language for the terms, compensation, removal, et cetera. Any questions from members of the committee? All right. Anyone want to make a motion? This goes to, does anyone else want to testify? Yes, welcome to the
Madam
committee.
Chair, members, thank you for the record. Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. This is the first we've seen of this amendment. It will increase the fiscal note on this bill, so we can address that in the new version of the fiscal note. However, I do want to bring to your attention language on 2.14 to 2.15, which is a large deviation from the existing bill. It was not discussed in the policy committee. This would change the language in the bill, which
could
is
you say those? There are two things you said. First of all, the composition is because the advisory group is getting larger?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay. Then what was your second comment?
The language in the amendment on lines 2.14 to 2.15, which basically now would prohibit wolf hunting and trapping on all private land contained within reservation boundaries, is a large deviation from the discussion that occurred in the policy committee, which just prohibited wolf hunting and trapping within federally recognized tribal lands. This has an impact of over approximately 660,000 acres of privately owned land within the reservation boundaries that if this issue was never discussed in the policy committee, Madam Chair. Over 96% of some of the 96% of the land owned within the White Earth Indian Reservation boundaries are privately owned. They own 4% of their land approximately. So you're impacting hundreds of thousand acres of privately owned
land. Right, and this actually is not something within our jurisdiction. But Senator Hur, could you talk a little bit about that 214, 215, why that's in your amendment?
I'll defer my answer to Dr. Hackett.
Dr. Hackett.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we have heard repeatedly from members of the Anishinaabe Ojibwe culture, and basically the language before you states that if the Indian tribes themselves request no hunting, that then it be granted within to the exterior boundaries of the Indian reservation. The reason for that is on the reservation they see that the wolf is an animal that they would like to see protected, and to have a hunting go on like other animals are come to an agreement and hunted for on their lands, they find it quite disrespectful. And we put this in the language because we do think the wolf is different, and by the way the wolf behaves and the miles that it travels in a day. What was testified to was the fact that they don't want any hunting, period, whether it's on their land or not. But out of respect for these neighbors of ours, state, we put it out to the boundaries of the Indian reservation.
Dan Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me like outside of almost the merits of the policy that this is not an appropriate portion of this amendment, it almost seems like it was attempted to be snuck by the committee here. I won't impugn the motives of the author or anyone else, but it seems that way. Madam Chair, given the fact that this isn't within the jurisdiction of the committee and it seems like a great departure as the department has outlined, I would move an amendment to strike lines 2.14 and 2.15 from the amendment or in the bill if we've adopted the amendment.
You can amend the amendment.
Okay.
So your amendment is to amend the A2 amendment by deleting lines 2.14 and 2.15.
If I could speak to that just a bit, members of the committee, this is outside of the jurisdiction of the committee. Most of us have not been here to listen to the full policy debate. As the department has outlined, this encompasses over 500,000 acres of privately owned land. This is not something that this committee should take up under the guise of doing an overview on a task force. And on the merits of that alone, Madam Chair, I would urge the committee to strike this and have this language worked out moving forward with the advocates. If the Department of Natural Resources didn't know about it until right now, I would say that it's not a well-vetted position.
Madam Chair, Senator Wicklund.
Madam Chair, just wondering where does this bill go after?
Close to finance.
Okay.
And it'll be in the Environment Economic Development Subcommittee of Finance probably.
Madam Chair, would that be an appropriate place to discuss something like this, or is it a policy change?
Yeah, I think that would be more appropriate than here, for sure. Any other comments, Senator Eaton?
I just had a question. maybe Mr. Myers could answer. If you look at the original bill on 2.7, that notwithstanding paragraph A, if requested by tribal leadership, the commissioner shall close federally recognized tribal lands to hunting and trapping wolves. I'm wondering what the difference is between that and the language we find in the amendment.
Commissioner.
Senator Eaton, the language, I believe the intent of the language that was discussed, at least in the Environment Policy Committee, these are tribally owned lands within the reservation boundaries, just like any other private landowner. And we do publish on our regulations and on our website that tribally owned lands are off limits. It's against the law to hunt on those lands. So, in effect, we just thought this was conforming language with what we're doing in law right now. The amendment is expanding that prohibition to all of the lands that are within the boundaries of the reservation boundaries. So within the reservation boundaries, there's many reservations that contain hundreds of thousands of acres of privately owned lands, and that's the concern that we have.
The difference from Red Lake, which is all tribally owned,
exactly.
And White Earth, okay. Which has private ownership within the reservation.
Madam
Sarah
Chair, I guess I understood that the original language meant what the amended language meant, and I would speak in favor of it and against the amendment to the amendment.
Okay. Any other discussion? Yeah, Ms. Hackett.
If I could clarify, Madam Chair, we did get informed from several tribal members that we needed to make it more exact because of this clarification. But 96% of the White Earth reservation being privately owned, well, county and state land is also on there, and they're asking that part of the reason you call it a reservation is because the tribes do monitor things and do have oversight on what happens on their lands and work with the DNR on that, and didn't feel like they were really listened to about the wolf issue. And a wolf will travel 30 miles in one day, so 500,000 acres is really not very much for a wolf. So given the fact that we have so few wolves and they are teeter on the brink of extinction or endangerment, we made this amendment to make it very clear as we move forward with this bill.
Sam Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not actually haven't really engaged in the debate about the merits of doing it or not. I would suggest to the committee that if it's going to environment finance, why not offer the amendment in environment finance when you've got members of the committee who have spent a great deal of time on this issue? If we're going to go about the business of state and local government, as has been pointed out by the chair, I think in every committee meeting we've had, I would say that we ought to stick to that, especially, again, in light of the fact that the department, again, really had no idea. I mean, made aware of this literally on the fly. This will give time for the stakeholders to get together and make a decision, and it may be the appropriate one, Madam Chair.
I actually tend to agree with Senator Peterson. On the merits of the issue, I might support this, but because of the process, I think we should take it out. Senator Johnson?
Madam Chair, my sentiments are the same. It's not because I would be against it, but I think after the way this committee has worked, I think it would be more appropriate.
Okay, on the Peterson motion to delete lines 2.14, 2.15 in the A2 amendment, I don't think we're even going to take testimony on it because I think we need to just make a decision about whether we're going to discuss this or not. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
Nay.
No.
Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. On the, is there anything else in here that
Madam Chair,
would be a surprise to us, Senator Herr? Sarah Eaton.
I believe all we did was remove those lines from the amendment. We haven't adopted the amendment yet.
We did adopt the amendment. We had already adopted the amendment, which, right.
I guess I missed that.
Yeah,
sorry.
We had.
I don't think we did.
Right? Yeah. Who?
I made the amendment, Madam Chair, and I really don't think we did either.
Do we? I'm asking the staff about adopting the amendment. Ms. James thinks we did.
Adopt the amendment.
And all the senators.
Senator Johnson. Senator Johnson moved the amendment, and we adopted it.
I did.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, okay. Is there anyone else in the audience that, since we didn't take much testimony, that wants to just briefly address the committee? All right. Is there anyone who wants to make a motion? Senator Eaton?
I'd like to move passage of this and have it referred to
finance.
Finance.
Senator Eaton moves that Senate File 2256 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Didn't really listen for the nays because the ayes were strong. All right, we're following the agenda still. Senator Sieben. Okay, great. I'm moving. I'm trying to move fast. Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair and committee members, the bill that's before you today, Senate File 1835, allows for school districts to create more transparency and accountability when it comes to health insurance. There are specific components of the legislation that I'm happy to talk about. I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if you want to somewhat limit the discussion on the bill to issues that relate to state and local government.
Yeah, if you could give us a general overview of what the bill does and then focus more on things that are in our jurisdiction.
So, Madam Chair, perhaps, and then I also have an A-12 amendment, which I don't know at what point you'd like to have that. The A-12 amendment does have some substantive changes that were a result of negotiations between interested parties as the bill has been moving through. So perhaps
I think we need a general overview of what the bill does, and then we can look at the amendment.
So, Madam Chair and members, going through the amended version of the bill, or the bill that's before us, it requires public school districts I'll just go through it section by section. Section 1 subjects the public employee insurance program to group insurance bidding requirements. Section 2 requires public employees insurance program, or PEEP, to respond to requests for proposals for school district health insurance coverage within 60 days. Section 3 outlines some of the duties and powers of the service co-ops board of directors, and provides that the service co-ops when discussing health insurance, that they're subject to open meeting law. Section 4 provides that service co-op advisory councils are public bodies. Again, this is regarding the open meeting law. Section 5 requires that an entity must negotiate with exclusive representative with respect to insurance premiums returned to that entity by a service co-op. Section 6 prohibits a school board. This is a pretty substantial change. It prohibits a school board member or school district employee from receiving gifts. Section 7 makes board members and officers of charter schools subject to the gift ban. So Section 6 and 7 relate to the gift ban. Section 8 establishes requirements for charter schools and mandates that they, when they go out to seek their group insurance coverage, that they must get proposals for coverage from three sources every 3 years, and must notify employees of the change in the group coverage policy. Section 9 relates to collective bargaining and adds insurance coverage provided by PEEP or a service co-op to the definition of group insurance coverage. Sections 10, 11, and 12 are conforming. Section 13 requires that school districts that school districts must get bids for health insurance at the end of their contract for health insurance, or every 24 months. And then sections 14 and 15 are, again, the gift ban and just the effective date. So, members, the overall intent of this bill is to say that school districts, when they're going to look for new health insurance coverage, should go out and get bids. And nothing in the legislation specifies that they need to pick a particular bid that they get. But the idea here is that it's helpful for the public, for limited tax dollars, for school districts to essentially shop around when seeking coverage for their employees' health insurance.
Great. Thank you. Any questions on the bill itself, then why don't you take us through the A-12 amendment?
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask Mr. Retke from Education Minnesota to go through the A-12 amendment.
Mr. Retke.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Brandon.
The first part of the – oh, I'm sorry. This is Brandon Retke, Education Minnesota, Director of Public Affairs. The first line, line 1.2 of the amendment deletes lines 4 to 12 on page 4. And as Senator Sieben mentioned, that was the provision around the service cooperatives that if there was refund money that came back to the schools from the service co-ops, they would have to negotiate over how that would apply with the school district, or in absence of an agreement, it would apply to reducing premiums for a proportional share. What we're doing with that is actually moving that out of the service co-op section of statute into the school district section of the statute, which is reflected on lines 1.7 through 1.18 of the amendment.
So you're just moving it from one
from
section
service
to
co-op
another.
From the service co-op statute to the school district statute. So basically it wouldn't just be if a service co-op was giving a refund. If it's any entity that provides health insurance to a school district is providing refunds back to the district, the district would have to notify the exclusive rep. Okay. They would negotiate how that would be applied for insurance, and if they couldn't reach an agreement, there would be a standard way that it would be applied to offset the proportional share of the premiums that the employees and the employers have paid. Then line 1.3 of the amendment, where it deletes line 22, everything after section and insert 123B, that's just changing the reference because we moved it out of the service co-op back into the school district section in the statute, so that's fixing that statutory reference. And then, as we said, lines 1.7 through 1.18 is adding that basically that language under the school district section of statute, not the service co-op. On line 1.19 of the amendment, which says page 7, line 4, that's just changing the line from provision to section. That's just a clarity change. And then page 9 is where some of the more substantive changes are lines 19 through 23. These are, in the last committee, we made some clarifications around districts that are opting for self-insurance, and this is some further clarification in that language on the timelines that self-insured districts would be under for their self-insurance bidding, and that was actually in response to some of the issues that were raised by districts on amending some of the timelines that they needed for their specific districts.
We only had one testimony. Any questions on the A-12 amendment?
Sure.
Senator Wicklin?
Madam Chair, Senator Sieben, or Mr. Retke, for the line 1.23 where it talks about proposals must be submitted at least 60 days, does it give them, are they able to open or process the proposals more than 60 days in advance then? Does this language allow them to do that? I would just want to confirm that.
Madam Chair, Senator Wicklin, yes, that is the intent of that language. Was we heard from different districts that 60 days was too short of a time frame because if they're, depending on when their insurance comes up, the enrollment period could be in the summer when people weren't around. So some people wanted longer. When we actually had in 150 days, some districts said that's too long. We don't want to do it 150 days. So this language reflects that as long as they do it at least 160 days before, so there's ample time to examine and make any changes before the expiration. They can go longer if whatever the district decides is the appropriate timeline for them.
So at least 60 days?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there opposition to this?
I don't know. I'm going to ask about testimony. Senator Sieben?
Well, Madam Chair, I would say that we've been working with interested parties, and we've made quite a lot of changes, I think, to reflect the needs of school districts, the co-ops, and self-insured districts. But they can speak for, you know, they can obviously speak for themselves.
Okay. So if there are no questions right now, on the amendment, are we ready to adopt the amendment? Senator Johnson moves the A-12 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Then Mr. Michael McKenzie.
Madam Chair,
yes.
He was testified to, or he was slated to speak, but he was unable to make it now today, so you can skip him.
Okay. Is there anyone here who wants to testify either for or against this bill? All right, is there a motion?
Madam Chair, I think there, could I hear from Fred Nolan? I know he had a concern, and I okay. It doesn't mean he's for or against, but I just wanted to make sure that his concerns were heard by the committee members.
That's so good. I know I'm just conscious of how many bills we have on the agenda, so do stop me if I'm going too fast. I don't want to screw up. So, thanks. Mr. Nolan.
Yes, I'm Fred Nolan, representing the Minnesota Rural Education Association, an association of 175 school districts educating 160,000 students. 700 of our districts are, 100 of our districts are less than 700 kids. They have like two administrators, one and a half administrators, or one. I have a question on why we're here today. We're not opposed to this. We want some clarification because the new HIDTA requirements on Section 13, Subdivision 8, if you turn to line 8.18, appear to place the insurance bid requirements on each school district. HIDTA says that school districts shall, and then goes into great detail about the new bidding process for group health insurance. But we're not understanding how the Joint Power Statutes 471.59 functions with this new proposal. And I'm looking for assurance that my members, the districts, can delegate the process described in Subdivision 8 to a Joint Powers Board. We've been doing this for 20 years to buy furniture and do our special education and buy insurance. We need the clarification because especially in a business sector that takes such specialized knowledge to form RFPs and compare bids and apples to apples, it's going to take our focus of our administrators off educating kids into an area they're very unfamiliar with, and we've delegated this to joint powers. We just want to make sure that 471.59 still functions within this bill, and I think it's germane to this committee to address that. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. In response?
Madam Chair, this was an issue that was just raised with me and the proponents of it over the weekend, so there isn't any real clarity yet, I think, on the concerns that were raised. If Mr. Retke wants to weigh in more, if you'd allow for him to, that would be helpful.
Mr. Retke.
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think, as Senator Stevens said, this is a issue that was raised over the weekend, and we're still examining how that would work. I think our intent of the bill is not to say that a district couldn't do that. I think what we're wanting to examine thoroughly before we is how some of those joint powers agreements serve as both potentially a bidder and a
biddy.
And a biddy, right. Someone who's preparing and submitting and sending out RFPs, but also an entity that is also bidding on those RFPs and making sure that there are some clear, bright lines about the different functions that the joint powers can agreement follows. So those are some of the things I think we're still needing to examine and look into. And
this bill is going to Judiciary Committee from here.
Correct.
And then I'm not sure where else. Finance, then?
Yes, Madam Chair.
And if I could just add one thing, Madam Chair. If you look at the number of changes we've made in this bill throughout Senator Stevens' multiple author's amendments, we've shown a great ability to make changes and honor and try to respect the differences that have come up to try to find agreement, I think.
Great.
We're trying to get away, find a way that everybody can be supportive of the bill.
And address Mr. Nolan's concerns.
Yeah. Madam Chair, I just wanted to clarify that in one of the earlier stops, we took out the appropriation to PEEP. So right now, I don't anticipate that it will have to go to the Finance Division.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But it is going to Judiciary next. Senator Wicklund. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I do have just one concern I'd like to raise, and it's sort of, I don't know if it's germane exactly to this committee, but since I've been working with Senator Sieben kind of as this bill has gone through education policy, and I have heard concerns back and forth from my district and others, just one question I had about we're going to be asking school districts to get more bids than they have in the past. More bids will need to be generated, and I'm wondering if you've put any thought into how we're going to examine whether that's driving the right behavior. I mean, we want to drive costs down for districts. We want them to get better, lower-cost insurance. But is there any mechanism that you're going to use to see if that's happening or not? I guess I have concern that the bidding work takes time as well, and obviously time is money, both for people to analyze them in the districts and also for companies to produce the bids. So just curious whether that's been discussed at all.
Madam Chair, Senator Wicklund, members of the committee, I can tell you that from Education Minnesota's perspective, and I think Senator Dahl can tell you this from and you as being on a school board and Senator Dahl from negotiating on the teacher side, that you know, insurance and how much is going to be paid is one of the biggest expenses, one of the biggest issues that happens in negotiations. And so we do not want to be in a situation where we're unduly actually raising the cost of health insurance for our members, because it ends comes right out of their pocket. And so the one thing about this bill is that we will be able to see in every district if multiple bidding and competitive bidding is driving down the costs. And we will have data on every single district that is now receiving, will be receiving multiple bids, which currently isn't the practice. And I think every example we've heard from our members is when they've sought multiple bids, bids have come back in lower. And I think we will now, as Education Minnesota, we will be definitely doing research and charting how this is affecting every single school district and the amount of bids they've got in, what the trend line has been on the bids, the coverages that have been provided, because it is the, you know, one of the biggest issues for our members economically. We do not want to be in a situation where we unduly made it more difficult for them.
And Madam Chair, I would just add that since the bill was introduced, there has been language that has been changed to about surrounding the length of the contract, or when I should say when the bids are required. So we're trying to be responsive to school districts who are saying we don't want to go out for and have to request bids more often than is practicable or more often than we need, which I think is why the language regarding school districts seems to work for many of them in terms of the they have to get bids at the end of their current contract, for example, instead of every 2 years as it was when the bill was first introduced. So that should help address that somewhat as well.
Madam Chair,
Senator Wicklund.
That does address, and I'm hoping that, you know, that will be a part of the future years that we will be able to see, you know, and if Education Minnesota is doing surveys and research on that, I think that will be important to conduct. So, thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Any motions? Senator Dahl.
I'd like to move Senate File 1835 and to pass and refer to Judiciary.
As amended.
As amended.
Senate Dahl moves that Senate File 1835 is amended, be recommended to pass, and re-referred to the Committee on Judiciary. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just voted aye, but I didn't mean to. Not a member of the committee.
Is Senator Clausen? Senator Clausen.
I sit on the thing of the council, and the senators and representatives don't know.
We're moving a little quicker.
Somebody always says, we're non-voting.
Should have skipped this meeting.
Senator Clausen, welcome to the committee. Senate File 2309. And with your testifier.
3 years probation as a teacher.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members, and thank you for the opportunity to meet with you and present Senate File 2309. The Local Public Health Act, which provides a foundation organizing framework for Minnesota's local health care system. The Local Public Health Act was passed in 1976, and Senate File 2309 clarifies public health responsibilities. It eliminates unnecessary and obsolete language and aligns the statute with current public health practices. The proposed changes were developed by the Minnesota Department of Health in partnership with local government representatives and stakeholders. And with us today from the Minnesota Department of Health is Ms. Trash. She will thrash, thank you, who will provide an overview of the bill.
Great. Ms. Thrash, we're really just looking for kind of a summary of the bill and specifically point out things that are in our jurisdiction, which would be local state government, and what else?
Madam Chair, from the local government perspective, sections 9, 10, parts of section 14, and all of section 15 are the main local government issues, and I think Ms. James may have more.
Say that again, 9, 10.
9, 10, parts of 14 and 15.
Parts of 14 and 15. And anything else, Ms. James?
I will keep looking. I'm
okay.
Remembering.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you can go through it quickly.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Allison Thrash. I am not the director of the Office of Performance Improvement. I'm a supervisor in that office, but have been staff to this work over the past several years. As Senator Claussen mentioned, Chapter 145A, the Local Public Health Act, is the foundation for Minnesota's state and local public health system. When it was passed almost 40 years ago, the act was seen as revolutionary and a model for the rest of the country. It provides a financial incentive for counties to voluntarily join together to have a large enough population base to support a range of public health services in the community. At the time that the act was passed, there were something like 2,000 local boards of health. After a few years, that went down to 50-some community health boards representing the entire state. So one board of health for every city and township to 50 covering the state. The act created a way for state and local governments to work in partnership and to communicate, and it describes the commissioner's responsibilities to help and support local health departments. I'd also like to point out that it created a unique advisory board called the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, or SHAC. And SHAC brings together local government representatives, county commissioners, public health directors, with the commissioner of health and key staff from MDH to make sure that we're well coordinated in an agreement about our approach to public health in the state. I mention this because Senate File 2309 was developed in that spirit of partnership by a SHAC work group. The work group went about its work very thoughtfully, having discussions over the course of more than a year, which enabled it to reach a consensus on proposed changes. And they had three goals that they were working toward. First, keep what works in our strong and longstanding foundation. Second, align the statute with current practices. As you might be able to infer, a lot has changed since 1976, not just the public health issues, but the workforce and the increased attention to reporting and accountability. And third, make the statute easier to understand. In particular, the work group wanted to reduce duplication in the language and more clearly identify local responsibilities.
Is this your unsession, their unsession bill?
It kind of started that way, yes. Actually, even before the unsession was an idea, that was our intent to sort of streamline the language.
Clean up the language.
That's right. Yeah. And in regard to what is within your jurisdiction, sections 9 through 13 are primarily cleaning up, deduplicating, removal of an outdated term, the local board of health, and replace it with the term community health board or county and city as appropriate to the jurisdiction. I think there was also a question about section 14, which addresses the duties required of community health boards. That section was rewritten to make local responsibilities more clear, and there was one additional duty added, which is to implement a performance management process to assure continuous improvement at the local level. In closing, the changes in Senate File 2309 were taken around the state for discussion and vetting by local public health leadership. They were approved by SHAC, the advisory committee I mentioned earlier. And this bill is supported by the Local Public Health Association, the Association of Minnesota Counties, the Minnesota Intercounty Association, and the Minnesota Public Health Association. And I just want to add that representatives of the Local Public Health Association had planned to be here today to testify in support of this bill, but were unable to make it due to illness and the poor travel conditions in outstate. Thank you, Madam
Chair. Is it snowing or sleeting or raining or something outstate?
It was this morning, and the representative who was to testify was coming from St. Cloud.
Yeah. Any questions from members of the committee? Anyone in the audience want to testify on this bill? Okay, any motions?
Either one.
Who's okay. fighting over that? It depends if I look to the left or the right.
I'll move it.
All right, Senator Dahl. Whoever speaks up, Senator Dahl.
I'd like to move Senate File 2309, recommended to pass and refer
to the floor.
Senator
Claussen moves that Senate File 2309 be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Senate File 2271. Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm here to present Senate File 2271. It's the Met Council unsession bill, so we will stick with the theme of the unsession. Before I go through the bill, I was wondering, there's an oral amendment I'd like to make before we get started, and then we can kind of go back through. When the bill was heard in the other body, the modified language, it shows up on page 3, lines 3.14 and 3.15 and 3.16. And it was decided that the existing language should stay rather than being stricken. And then the new words should be removed, correct?
Yep.
So the language, buses and coaches, commuter, rail, locomotives and coach cars, light rail vehicles, up and paratransit vehicles that are, that should be unstricken.
Okay. So I believe the motion is to... To reinstate the stricken language and delete rolling stock on 316.
And delete the new language, any rolling stock.
And any, okay. So Senator Wicklund moves, this is an author's, your first committee, right, author's amendment, to reinstate the stricken language on line 3.14, 3.15, and to delete any on 3.15, and delete rolling stock on 3.16.
That's correct.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you. And so now going back to the beginning, I'm wondering if there's lots of sections. I can quickly speak to what's changed in the first, 21 sections are language changes. This bill repeals obsolete, unused, and redundant provisions, and it also deletes references to deadlines that have passed. I can go through.
I think you should go through it. I mean, I think that, I don't know if Senator Hall had a chance to look at this bill in some of our earlier meetings in the governor's office or not. So I think it might be a good idea to go through it. Met Council is always a
I'll walk through the first section 1 through 22, and then I'll let, 21, and then I'll let Mr. Shenton go through the repeal language, which is sections 22 onward. So section 1 deletes a requirement that the council's annual budget provide a separate account of specified categories. This a similar requirement already exists in section 473.13, which is the Met Council's budget statute. Section 2 deletes a reference to positions that are no longer used or are repealed in this bill. Section 3 deletes a paragraph that is date-specific, and that date has passed. Section 4 is the one we just modified. I don't know if there are any other changes.
We have one piece in
there. There's one.
Yep.
Okay.
It deals with best value. A verbiage change.
There's a wording change in the section or paragraph B that has to do with best value. It makes the language... more clear.
Yep.
Section 5 deletes a reference to a deadline that has passed and changes the word economic to economical.
Oh, I remember this.
Economical was what was used throughout, and so this makes it consistent. The Section 6 deletes language because the provisions are obsolete. The council has not been involved in these approval processes since the early 80s, and funding sources named do no longer exist. Section 7, these dates are no longer necessary, and the language can be streamlined by removing them. Also, there is date-specific and obsolete language that's removed in Subdivision 3A, number 5. And the date-specific reference in Clause 6 can be deleted because the August 1st, 2004 date has already passed. And municipalities are notified annually of their affordable and life cycle housing opportunities amount for the following calendar year. Section 8, the date-specific reference in Subdivision 4 can be deleted because it's unnecessary. The requirements in Subdivision 4 are ongoing. Reference to Subdivision 3 should be deleted if the obsolete Subdivision 3 is repealed as recommended in the above section. Section 9, deletion of paragraph B is clerical because Subdivision 4 was amended in 2004 and no longer contains a paragraph B. First sentence of Subdivision 5, paragraph B is obsolete. And the council's obligation to credit the solid waste bond proceeds to the local housing incentives account was a one-time obligation that was fulfilled many years ago. Section 10, the change would make this provision consistent with other statutory provisions that use the statutory defined term implementing agency, which are the agencies to which the council provides parks grant funding.
I want to interrupt for a minute and go back to Section 9. Sure. It's talking about the council annually credit $1 million and shall annually transfer $500,000. I mean, these amounts were determined in 1997. Has there been any need to index them or to change the amount, or is it still roughly the same? I would imagine that the rest of the budget has grown and these have kind of stayed stagnant.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Judd Shetton, and I'm the Government Affairs Director for the Metropolitan Council. And Madam Chair, to that comment, we at the Council, after we met with you and others before bringing this bill forward during the session, we are looking at that right now, but for the purposes of our on-session bill, you know, that's a policy issue that we didn't want to bring forward because that would be a different conversation than trying to just get rid of old and obsolete references in statute. But we are looking at that, and thank you for referencing again. But, again, for the purposes of this bill, we felt that that would be a change that would go beyond just trying to clean up our statutes.
Okay. Thank you. Proceed.
Madam Chair, Section 11, Subdivision 11, originally was enacted in 1984 and applied to the former Regional Transit Board. The advisory committee likely was intended to help the new RTB initiate a ride-sharing program. The advisory committee provision is no longer necessary because the council has the general authority to appoint advisory committees under a different Minnesota statute section. Section 12, the second paragraph in Subdivision 1E was enacted in 1998 when the council was closing its bus garage on Snelling Avenue and searching for a new facility site. That site was identified and the bus garage was relocated and constructed many years ago. Section 13, this text can be eliminated because it's permissive and because the council has this authority anyway. In the past, the council has hired consultants to help with route planning and scheduling for major studies. Section 14, the provision dates back to the mid-70s when the privately owned Twin Cities line was acquired by the former MTC through condemnation, and none of the advertising contracts that existed at that time currently exist. Section 15, this is a clerical change. The council no longer has an office of transit operations. The council provides public transit services through its Metro Transit division. Section 16, Subdivision 5 is specific to the council's Environmental Services division. These grants have not been available since the late 1980s. Section 17, Subdivision 11 is specific to the Council's Environmental Services Division. The last three sentences of Subdivision 11 are not necessary. There's another section in Statute 473.5111 governs reconveyance and disposition of interceptors that are no longer needed for the regional wastewater treatment system. Section 18, this date is passed and is no longer needed since this is incorporated practice. Section 19, the deadlines can be removed because they've passed. The new text reflects the review process the council actually uses. Section 20, the December 31st, 1976 deadline has long since passed. Section 21, the December 31st, 1976 deadline has long since passed, and the other text changes are clerical. And now I'll let Mr. you can go through the repeal section.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. What I would like to do here with the repealer section is just walk through them briefly for you, but I also would like to comment to let you know that with the amendment that was added, we decided to go ahead and keep that that language, because what we were trying to do with this bill is to be a clear, concise, get rid of obsolete language and any types of redundancies. And in the House, they decided that it was clearer just to keep the language there rather than rolling stock. We proposed rolling stock because it's an industry standard, but the committee chose was talked differently about or felt differently about that. So for the purpose of this bill, we want to be as clear as possible, and so we're happy to take that amendment. And if any of you have any questions about these things, again, we believe that all of these provisions are non-controversial, and happy to have that discussion if you have any questions.
With that amendment gone, do you still have to go to transportation policy? Was that the reason they asked for it? Do anybody know?
Madam Chair, members, there are a few transit related issues here. Again, we're not adding any authority, but I think for the purposes of just making sure that everybody signs off on it, that it's probably okay to go to transportation policy. But no further ado here, I'll go forward with the repealers. Under Section 22, we are repealing a provision that was enacted in 1994 when the legislature abolished the MTC, the Metropolitan Wastewater Control Commission, and the Regional Transportation Board, and transferred those duties to the council. The council never hired these performance and budget analysts, which are specific folks that can have a provide additional or separate advice to the council. Our council members, the council's never hired these folks, and we do have the authority under 473.129 if our council members were interested in doing that. But again, this has never been something that has been brought forward, so we thought for the purposes of cleaning things up, we would do that here.
Mr. Shenton, considering the fact that all of our councils have reviewed this both from the majority and the minority, and that there have been meetings in the governor's office, you can move a little more quickly unless members have questions.
Great. Thank you again, Madam Chair. Section 23, which deals with the budget financial aid, again, we have the detail for the consultant services as part of our overall budget, so we feel that that can go. The public facilities review, we feel that this is obsolete. The council prepared the inventory many, many years ago, and if we wanted to do it again, we have the authority under 473.242. Data collection, again, we feel this is unnecessary. The council already maintains this data center and works cooperatively with folks in order to build our data collection. And again, this piece goes back to 1975. 473.243 deals with emergency services. It's not mandatory, and the council's never provided or performed these functions. And again, this dates back to 1975. Special studies and reports, 473.244. This was originally enacted in 1967 when the council was established, and we think that this list that is before you in this section is very antiquated, and the council could engage in these studies without this particular statutory citation. On the 273.254, we believe it can be taken out entirely because it's date-specific and the requirements were fulfilled over 20 years ago. 473.315, Subdivision 2, deals with grants. It can be repealed because it was intended to make it possible for the council to make park grant funding available. And this goes back to 1974. The council does not own or operate parks. We work as a partner with the implementing agencies. And again, it is just obsolete. And by getting rid of this, we are clarifying statute. The 473.326 deals with Como Park Zoo bonds. This goes back to the mid-1970s, and these bonds were retired almost 20 years ago. Under the council acquisition, 473.333, the council never used this authority, and we do not, again, own or operate regional park facilities, and this just clarifies statute as well, and it goes back to 1975. 473.375 deals with the powers of the council, but this goes specifically to our transit statutes, and we are asking to repeal this because the council has the ability to create any type of advisory committees under our general authorities. So this is just redundant. We are asking to repeal 473.382, deals with local planning and development program. This was originally enacted in 1984 and applied to the RTB. And when the RTB was abolished, those authorities transferred to the council. However, as the Metropolitan Planning Organization recognized by the federal government, we have this authority in a different section of statute. And we, again, are just asking to repeal this for clarification reasons. 473.392 deals with service bidding. Again, this applied to the RTB, and the RTB was abolished in 1984, and the council procures our transit service through procurement rather than service bidding. And through that procurement, we have to follow all federal, state, and council-adopted procedures. So by getting rid of this, we, again, are just clarifying statute and cleaning it up. 473.516 deals with waste facilities. It gives us a specific ability to enter into sludge ash contracts, and the council has the authority under the Uniform Municipal Contracting Law to do that, and this is one specific citation that allows us to do something that we're not sure why that is there, so we're just asking to repeal that. 473.517, again, that deals specifically with our wastewater statutes, and this goes back to the advisory committee statutes that we feel are redundant because we have the general authority already. This 473.352 deals with a manager's authority to enter into a construction contract. This goes back to the Municipal Wastewater Control Commission, and the council does not need this authority. We have the authority under our under the council's general statutes. And the last two here, one of them deals with the capital improvement program budget. It is specific to wastewater again, and this is part of our general budget statute 473.13 that we have to report that anyway, and we have the ability to issue debt in our general statutes, and this provision again goes back to 1975. The last repealer deals with the land use planning statutes, and it we are deleting language that relates to school districts, and the definition of school district is unnecessary because that section of law that required school districts to submit their capital improvement programs to the council was repealed in 2006. So, members, again, this is we are trying to just clean up old and obsolete language and hopefully make our statutes clearer. And I appreciate Senator Wicklund for carrying the bill, and I'll answer any questions you may have.
Any questions? Okay, then motion.
Madam Chair, move that Senate file number 2271 be recommended to pass as amended and referred to transportation. Is that what you said?
Yes, transportation policy.
Transportation policy.
Okay. Anyone else in the room want to comment? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. All right, thank you.
Great, appreciate it.
Jensen's thank here. You. Well, we'll take Senator Jensen's bill sure. next. She's here. $23.99. Senator Jensen, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is Senate File 2399. I do have an author's amendment, the A3.
Is that good? It's been handed out? Okay. A lot of capital letters here. Sorry.
Trying to get your attention, Madam Chair.
That's how they do it, right? I figured. This is an author's amendment. Does somebody want to move it? Senator Dahl moves the. I was looking to the right this time. moves the A3 author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Okay, Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In 1963, there was a law that enabled the creation of District 1 Hospital District, which is located in Rice County in Faribault. And the language, when it was originally enacted, prohibited the district from selling. And circumstances are a little different now in 2014 than they were back in 1963. So the need for the kind of hospital that District 1 Hospital is needs some ability to sell. I have with me today Stephen Pribble. He is the chief executive from District 1 Hospital. And so I'd like for him at this point to tell you a little bit about the story of District 1.
Thank you, Mr. Pribble, President Pribble.
Madam Chair and committee members, as Senator Jensen said, I'm Steve Pribble, Chief Executive Officer of District 1 Hospital in Faribault. I'm here to explain the legislation before you and tell the story of why we are bringing this bill forward at this time. First, I want to thank Senator Jensen for her leadership, advocacy, and support. I would also like to introduce and thank Kim Anderson, President of the Faribault Chamber, for taking time to be with us today. I believe the committee has a copy of the chamber resolution that was recently passed by the chamber board in support of this bill. In addition to Kim Anderson, Dr. Richard Berge is here. Richard is our vice chair of our board at District 1 Hospital and a longtime resident of Faribault. And as well in the audience is Dan McGinty from Alina Health. Simply stated, we are asking for your support in allowing the local community to make decisions regarding how we provide ongoing local access to primary and specialty health services to include hospital-based services. In today's challenging and changing healthcare environment, flexibility in the management, control, and operation of the hospital and working in a more integrated fashion will ensure local services long into the future. As Senator Jensen said, the enabling legislation that created District 1 Hospital stipulates that we cannot at any time sell, lease, or otherwise transfer the management or operation of the hospital. The bill before you effectively eliminates that obstacle, allowing our local governance board to consider options and be nimble in a time of rapid change. We are proud of the exceptional patient care we provide in partnership with our physician partners in the Faribault community. In southern Minnesota, we are blessed with a multitude of the highest caliber healthcare providers and systems. Given our proximity to those choices, we have seen our volumes diminish over the last 10 years. That reduction in volumes has led to operational losses 6 out of the last 7 years. In early 2011, we completed comprehensive, rigorous, and inclusive strategic planning. We did extensive research that demonstrated that the most viable, successful healthcare organizations in similar markets are integrated, hospital and physician practices together. As a result of that deep dive, our board created a new vision for healthcare in Faribault, and that is to be the community's first choice for integrated healthcare because we're first in quality, safety, service, and access. The key word in that vision is integrated. We determined through our planning process that the concept of integrated, that is working together for the benefit of our patients, is essential to providing comprehensive, seamless care. We further determined that the best match for District 1 Hospital is Alina Health. Alina has been in the community for almost 20 years providing primary and specialty care, and since 2009, Alina has been serving as our primary hospitalist medical staff taking care of hospitalized patients. We have multiple partnerships already in place with Alina, the most recent being a very successful District 1 Cancer Center in affiliation with Virginia Piper Cancer Institute. The opportunity to partner with Alina will allow for accelerating best practice, operational efficiencies, and access to capital. The possibility of working together will improve access to a more robust range of specialties and expand services, improve availability of financial resources, and further prepare for health reform. Since we announced our letter of intention to discuss our future with Allina, we've hosted over 25 staff and community forums where we described our vision, provided the background that led us to that vision, and described the steps necessary to get there. I would have to say the response has been very supportive and positive. Our board, composed of 9 community members, our chief of staff, and myself, have done our homework. We have completed our analysis and confidently believe integration will solidify the future of healthcare in Faribault. I ask for your support, and of course, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Pretty straightforward. Anyone else want to testify? Then is there a motion?
So moved.
Senator Hayden spoke up too quick. Senator Hayden, so moved. Move Senate File 2399 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the Tax Committee. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you
very
Madam
much
Chair,
and have a good, safe drive home. Senator Johnson, Senate File 2311.
If you want to take Senator Uyghur.
Okay.
As long as
we could take.
To
yeah, we could take Senator Uyghur.
Whoa. Or Don.
If you don't mind.
Because he's not on the committee. That's very nice. Yeah, Senator Thompson.
Just a question. We're moving through these pretty well. Do you think we're going to be able to go straight through and get them done, or do you anticipate coming back tonight?
I think we could go straight through if that works with everyone, because we could probably be done by 6 o'clock.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Not why break and come back for an hour.
Thank
we're
going
to have a long day on Friday, though, I think. By and large.
It'd be fun to come back.
Oh. Senator Uyghur.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, House File 683 creates a legislative water commission. I do have an amendment that was prepared at the suggestion of counsel and Greg Hubinger from the coordinating commission. If you could entertain that at this point, it would help flow for any testimony you would be hearing.
I'll move the
okay, is it, the amendment looks like it's talking about staffing and compensation and initial appointments to put it more in the form that fits with what we require in our committee.
Exactly.
Okay. All right. Senator Johnson moves the A2 amendment. Do you want to just explain it then in the context of the whole bill?
Yes. Madam Chair, overall the bill creates
I'm saying should we just adopt the
yes.
amendment? All right. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed nay. Motion prevails. Senator Uyghur.
And Madam Chair, members, overall the bill creates a legislative water commission, 12 members, 6 from each body, 3 from each party. And recognizing the various entities now that address water in our state, there are several, the PCA, Bowser, DNR, and Met Council, various conservation districts. There have been a number of recommendations that we provide some overall look to get the big picture on this. There's been testimony, and I'd like to ask the League of Cities, Craig Johnson, to enter the record about the rationale for it and the mechanics of how the commission would be appointed, et cetera. We can go through that as well. So if I could ask Mr. Johnson to testify.
Mr. Johnson, introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Craig Johnson with the League of Minnesota Cities. And it's actually my honor to be up here supporting House File 683. I'm not sure, I think would have been Representative Johnson at the time, was probably around when the Legislative Water Commission was last year. The chair, of course, Senator Pappas was around for that as well. But the history on this, members, is that we used to have several commissions that were made up on a bicameral basis of members from both parties, from both bodies, that met during the interim on the most complicated policy issues so that we didn't have issues coming up in 20 minutes on amendments, late one night during deadline week that nobody had talked about, and they involved 3 different agencies and federal and state and local law all intersecting, and no one had discussed them. We didn't have one body having hearings on it and the other body only seeing it in conference committee because no one there had had a hearing on it. That really didn't happen because all of the complicated issues, and in this case on water, were discussed during the interim by this group, and it left this core of people in both the House and the Senate that actually understood the issues and could advise the rest of their body on how that discussion had gone in the interim. And frequently they would make recommendations even of saying that this is an issue we all agreed should move forward this year, which obviously makes it a lot easier for a body to know what direction to move on certain things. And I think, as many of us have seen, especially in the last 5 years or so, water issues have just been getting higher and higher visibility, higher and higher cost for businesses, for residents, for local units of government to deal with, and getting more and more controversial and intertangled between agencies. So this group was one of many that in 1994, most legislative commissions were abolished as an efficiency in government move. This was one of those. And I really think it's well served as a time to bring it back. As many of you are aware, the entire North and East Metro right now is being formed as a groundwater management area. That's 51 communities. It's every city and township in Washington County, Ramsey County, the southern third of Anoka County, and the part of Minneapolis east of the Mississippi River are all going to have new water regulations on them. And the legislature is not really involved in doing that and won't really know what's happened on that process until someone gives you a report next year sometime. And this kind of group being around would be able to keep in touch with those kind of processes during the interim and really build that kind of understanding of water law amongst the members. And for those of us who work on this, that's just essential. The more members we have that understand the issues well, the easier it is for us as people trying to work with the legislature on these issues to have a good blend of people from both houses and both parties that can assist us in doing that work. So very grateful to the author for bringing the bill forward, and this is actually something both the League of Minnesota Cities and the State Water Utility Council, which is the people who run drinking water systems in public entities around the state, have been supporting for several years. I'd be happy to answer any questions on how this organization worked previously.
Are there any questions from the committee for Mr. Johnson? On the bill. How about, is a Mr. Len Price willing, wanting to speak?
Madam Chair, he was not able to make it.
Oh, okay.
But he's very supportive and was a member of that commission formerly. So.
And sure. Madam Chair, he was actually a member as a House member and as a senator. So.
Yeah. All right. Are there any further, any questions? Or okay. Seeing none, I would entertain a motion to pass House File 683 as amended and sent to Finance.
So moved.
Senator Scalzi moves House File 683 to pass and to go to Finance. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you very much.
Motion passes. Our next one. I think now we're at Johnson's. Senator Johnson.
Members, Senate File 2311 is a part of the on-session bills, and if you have a copy of the Senate Council research paper, it says Military Affairs Department, obsolete, redundant, and unnecessary laws elimination, and that is what is happening. We have an amendment. It's A32. So I'd like to move that. It's really just taking out a couple of the other repealers that were in the original bill that were taken out by the House, so we want to make it conform to the House.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. Is some, would you like to move the amendment?
I would, Madam Chair. I move the amendment A32 to Senate File 2311.
All those in favor, say aye.
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 Those opposed?
I have with me today Mr. Don Kerr from the Military Affairs Department, and he will tell you about the repealers, but basically, as the title said, they are outdated and not necessary in our statutes, according to Mr. Kerr.
Mr. Kerr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Don Kerr, the Executive Director of the Department of Military Affairs. Thanks for your time tonight. Mindful of that, I'll move quickly. Most of the things you see in the repealer go back to the original establishment of the modern National Guard in 1921. As a result of the National Defense Act of 1918, The Congress directed states to adopt certain elements in their own state statutes in exchange for federal recognition of their National Guard units that gave the feds control. And these are some pieces of statute that linger from that time, even though nearly all of them, in fact, I think all of them that remain, refer back to federal law. So they really are already covered in federal law as it oversees the National Guard and are unnecessary in the state books.
Are there any questions from members? Well, then, Senator Johnson moves Senate file 2311.
And as amended.
As amended, to be sent to the floor. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Thank you.
Bill is passed and sent to the floor. Senator Scalzi. Senator Scalzi, I see you have an author's amendment.
Thank you, Ms. Chair and members. Actually, that's not an author's amendment. That was an amendment that is proposed by Ms. James, the legal counsel for this committee. And before I go into the bill, maybe she'd like to explain that amendment.
Ms. James. Madam Chair and members, this makes a change to the rulemaking section on page 17, line 32 of the bill. That paragraph B authorizes the Pollution Control Agency to use the good cause exemption to prepare rules. And the intention of the bill was for the good cause exemption to apply to the promulgation of rules that are described in paragraph A. But there's nothing currently in paragraph B that narrows the scope of the good cause exemption application to paragraph A. So the amendment accomplishes that.
And Ms. Chair and members, I would move that amendment to the bill. It's not an author's amendment because this is our third stop.
Oh, this is not, it's not the delete all. No, all right. 2193. Okay, Senator Scalzi moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And just briefly to explain the bill, Senate file 2193 is a bill proposed by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it includes proposals for permitting efficiencies and duty changes of the agency. And this is our third stop. We've passed environment and energy, ag jobs and rural development, and then we have two more stops to go, judiciary after this, and then environment finance. Oh. So I don't know if you want us to go through the bill. We have with us here Kirk Kudelka, who's the assistant commissioner of the Pollution Control Agency. And so he could go through the bill or your staff. Or
I think maybe the whoever, Mr. Knopf, could point out what sections of the bill are under our jurisdiction. Ms. James.
Madam Chair and members, the rulemaking section, which All is right. section 13 on page 17 of the bill, are in the jurisdiction of this committee.
Okay. Is anyone interested in, did you give just kind of an overall goal of the bill already? I came in right when you started, so I might have missed that.
I would have Mr. Kudelka do that.
Okay. Madam Chair and committee members, for the record, my name is Kirk Kudelka with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and thank you for the time. As mentioned, this is an overall bill dealing with permitting and other regulatory efficiencies. There are a number of pieces in the bill dealing with ways to make permitting more efficient or ways to achieve our goals of protecting public health and the environment.
So this is one of the unsessioned bills?
Correct.
Okay.
Section 13 on page 17 is the piece dealing with rulemaking. What specifically the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is asking for here is we would like to change the non-federal water and solid waste permits from a 5-year duration to a 10-year duration. This would save time folks wouldn't have, if their facilities are staying the same, they wouldn't have a time to put together the application. The time that's needed are the contractors, or an application fee would be saved by those folks. What we're asking for here is the ability to make that change through rules, that simple changing it from a 5 to 10 year duration for those non-federal permits in an expedited manner.
And then what's provision B?
Provision B deals with, that's the ability to make those changes for the 10-year for the solid waste and then the water in section 4 of the bill, the water permits, 10-year permits.
What is the good cause exemption?
Madam Chair and committee members, a good cause exemption would allow for the agency to go in, publish notice with the revisor's office, and make the changes very quickly. The full rulemaking process would not be needed since the policy decision has already been made by the legislature, and this is conforming the rules to those changes.
Do you have any opposition to this bill? Is there anyone here who wants to testify? You haven't heard of any opposition?
Ms. Chair and members, we have been working with a couple of groups. We've been working with Minnesota Chamber and also MCEA. There's been some question. I think the MCEA question maybe would be answered best in the Environment Finance Committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Any other discussion? All right. Then make your motion.
I would move Senate File 2193 as amended to be passed, and I'm not sure which of
Judiciary.
Those two committees. Judiciary.
You heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Right, thank you. Now we have Senator Hayden's bill. Our last bill, so quicker than I thought.
Job team.
Well, the first four bills were really slow. These went. And I think that was good the way you planned it.
Good evening, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I have House File, Senate File 1775. It's an expansion of the existing state's vacation donation program. Madam Chair, members, currently the state employees may donate vacation time if they have a spouse or dependent facing a life-threatening illness. However, if the spouse or dependent passes away, employees may no longer use donated time to plan funerals or grieve. In your folders, you have a letter from state employee in favor of this bill, and with me today I have Richard K. So I don't want to mess up his name of MAPE to explain the bill.
Madam Chair, my name is Richard Kajewski, the Public Affairs and Communications Director for MAPE, the Minnesota Association for Professional Employees. As Senator Hayden indicated, the vacation donation program with the state of Minnesota allows a state employee to donate up to 40 hours of vacation leave each fiscal year to the sick leave account of another or other state employees. The current law allows a recipient employee to use those donations for a life-threatening condition of the employee, their spouse, or dependent child that prevents the employee from working. This legislation was a result of learning that under current state law, an eligible person that has exhausted their current and sick leave banks and their spouse or dependent dies, regardless of the hours that have been donated, their eligibility ends, and so does their pay. The illness at the point of death no longer exists for that employee, and they're cut off. And as I indicated before, their sick leave account and their vacation account has been exhausted in order for them to be eligible for that program. So this bill allows an employee to use up to 80 hours of vacation that's been donated to their account to continue pay while they put that loved one and close one into the ground. Senator Hayden indicated there's a letter from a state employee, and I'll just reference it, and this is what really brought this bill to light, to kind of put a face with the bill. And this applies to all state employees going forward, but Kelly Larson from Clearwater, Minnesota, lost his daughter, a 9-year-old daughter, to leukemia. And under this statute, at the point that his daughter passed on, he's no longer eligible to receive any pay with the state of Minnesota. So this gives them a little bit of time to get that loved one in the ground and to take care of some arrangements that we think are necessary. Madam Chair and members, I would tell you the state did come back with a $7,000 fiscal note. MMB did. and has agreed to absorb that cost, and so there is no fiscal implication through this bill.
We've still been requested, though, to send it to the Finance Committee, but it should be fine. Any questions? All right. Senator Hayden.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 1775 to go to the Finance Committee.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. We're even
Madam
done
Chair,
ahead
members.
Of time.
Yes. Good job.
Go, very Madam good. Chair. Thank you, everyone. Hopefully we didn't mess up too much by moving so fast. Thank you. We'll see you on Wednesday.